welcome to our show, Examine Life. It's been off to a rough start tonight, but we will continue. It's KKRN at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista at Round Mountain. And we are delayed, but we'll go ahead and cover multiple issues tonight.
I'm Steve.
I'm Pat.
And this is Examine Life. Plato said that the unexamined life is not worth living. So on our program, we examine different aspects of life and politics and human nature.
And tonight we're going to talk about capitalism and corporate America.
And we'll start with the history of capitalism a little bit and the history of corporate America to give you kind of a background on the field we'll be talking about. Obviously, capitalism is a great source of discussion among the different political sides of our country. Western capitalism has been defined in Chapter 21 of Human Action, the Scholar's Edition, as a record of steady rise in the wage earner's standard of living, the mark of which is its mass production for the mass consumption directed by the most energetic, far-sighted, risk-taking individuals. Its driving forces, the profit motive. Excess profit over loss can only happen in a growing economy and only to the extent the masses' standard of living improves and is not based on money alone.
And if you take the workers' point of view of capitalism, it might read something like, improvement in my well-being and my expected standard of living, when it reaches a point that I don't want to work anymore, that labor does not increase my leisure, then it becomes an evil and I don't derive gratification from it any longer.
Prior to the corporations as we know them today, there were in the 1500s to enable the sharing of costs and profits from ocean voyages to distant lands, the creation of the charter company.
The charter company was, if you think of the Columbus, and he needed huge sums of money. And after he had discovered the Americas and the queen had put up the money for him to come across the ocean, other countries wanted to do that. And in order to facilitate that, they created these charter companies that was a grant by the crown to give them trading rights. They would come together, the people that were going to take the voyage, and they got trading rights to wherever they landed. So if they landed in Cuba, say, which is now Cuba, and whatever they had there they brought back for trade, they had the right to trade at that place and those goods in that country when they came back. So it was kind of like a monopoly on trade in that particular location.
So, of course, back in those days, government was allowed to establish a monopoly.
Yes, yes. And they found that it cost much more money than one or two or five individuals wanted to put up, including the government, and often took many years. It would take 2 years for the voyage and another year or two to come back after they loaded the ship. And so there weren't any profits being realized for years. So the birth of the joint stock enterprise was created, where investors could contribute different amounts of money to fund the venture. And so they were called trading stock. Those holders were trading stock of the company and would share in the profits. So because they were in the business of trade, and that's the monopoly they had, that's why they were trading stock. It was a kind of stock. It was not a verb.
The common American company, and first of those were Hudson Bay Company in 1670 and South Sea Company in 1711. Shareholders were allowed to sell or buy shares freely. The Bank of England was set up this way in 1694 by the merchants. The first U.S. Corp was the Boston Manufacturing Company that processed cotton in 1813, and they closed in 1930.
And that company, the Boston Manufacturing Company, was one of the first corporations, but it also planted the seeds for the Industrial Revolution in the United States because they came up with a system of hydropower to power the newly built factory. up till then, cotton was spun on a wheel with a foot pedal, and the thread that came off of it went to a loom that was operated by manpower. And when the owner visited England and found that they had mechanized this process, he came back to the United States and set this up in 1813, the first corporation, and this was before power. So the hydropower is what would run the spinning wheel and the loom, and they became a factory. But the downside of that is also had to give birth to labor unions.
Well, the downside was the way they treated the workers, which gave birth to the labor unions. And that's a healthy version of the labor unions. You know, people were they were fed up with the conditions they had to work under. Of course, they could have chosen to go somewhere else, but they didn't like not eating. So they worked under those conditions. But when enough people had enough, then unions were formed, and that was a good thing. That was people taking care of the problems themselves, not involving government.
And the problem kind of grew because this was a new idea, this factory town, and they used to call them company towns because they would build the housing for the workers. Because you know there was no transportation, people had to walk to work, and they were located out on a river somewhere. They built this company town with a company store, and they expected their workers to work 12 hours a day, buy everything from the store. So if you lost your job, you lost your housing, and chances are your paycheck went to the store.
And like other natural human beings, they did that for their own personal gain. You know, the more they could get out of these people without actually enslaving them, the more they would do it. There's many people today who think they wouldn't do that, but once they start down that path, they want as much for themselves as they can get.
And the workers came up with the labor union concept that worked on their behalf against the management of company.
And workers were taken in by the idea that, hey, I can have a job, I can have a wage, I can eat, and I have a home provided for me.
So the Industrial Revolution here in the United States was a great thing. There was a lot of invention, but it also had that downside, and labor unions fulfilled that need.
And in their beginning, I'm sure that they were much more, because they were formed by the people, they were much more ethical at the time. And it's only, there's nothing wrong with the concept of labor unions, but like everything else, they reach a certain maturity, and they grow beyond what they need to be.
Going back to the stock trading and the people that handled that stock trade, because you could buy and sell your shares and in that company that you invested in, think about the guy who has the money and the guy that has the stock. The guy that has the stock says, well, I'll give you my stock when you give me the money. And the guy goes, well, I got to go to the bank. And so they wound up with brokers who held the stock until the other guy came up with the money. He gave it to the broker, and then he was delivered the stock. So that's how brokers came along to facilitate that buying and selling of those stock trades.
And they, in the U.S. in 1792, after William Dewar tried to corner the market on the first bonds at a 6% rate issued by the U.S. government to pay for the Revolutionary War, which was Alex Hamilton's idea, and went bankrupt, 24 brokers decided to trade among themselves on Wall Street, shutting out the crooked bond auctioneers. And, of course, I have to make the point that William Dewar, who was he? Well, he was a state senator and a Continental Congressman, of course.
And probably trading on insider knowledge.
Yep.
But the stockbrokers themselves, because this was a risky business of buying and selling stocks, and it was considered a gambling aspect, they called themselves the Stock Exchange, and the 24 of them happened to meet on Wall Street, and that's how we got the Wall Street Stock Exchange.
And in the 1850s and the 1860s, the Erie Railroad controlling interest caused greed and ego, forcing the practice of the registration of securities and short sellings. Before that, it was self-regulated and privately run. The Erie Railroad, though, in my opinion, a big part of the reason all this got out of control is because they were heavily subsidized by the federal government. And so they had a lot of money to play with, and they probably had a lot of friends in government, and they felt a little more invincible because of that.
And the railroad had this notion that they would go to states or towns and say, you know, you give us the land and we'll build the railroad and thereby create towns and enterprise and commerce. And a good example of how that doesn't necessarily work very well is our neighboring Trinity County, who is the railroad still owns huge sums of land in Trinity County, and yet there is not 5 feet of railroad in that county. Because the railroads had a way of manipulating local governments into giving them land.
I guess it's a little hard to let go.
Yeah.
Just you got it, why let it go?
But up until then, the stock market was self-regulating, and it was privately run. It was not a public entity like it is now.
And in 1890, the Sherman Antitrust Act tried to limit Rockefeller's Standard Oil when the monopoly practices came to light, but only after female writer Ida Tarbell in 1902 and 1904 published a lot of articles on what was really going on at Standard Oil.
And this is the power of the press. It was through her articles that she really got to get the attention of the government to start regulating these big monopolies, because that's what Standard Oil was at that time.
And, of course, just to put a little damper on the idea of any government interference, which, of course, you all know by now, that's my mantra. In the 1907 stock market panic, which isn't talked about much because it was resolved by private businessmen and didn't last very long, that Antitrust Act actually had to be suspended as part of the process of shortening and ending that panic and that collapse.
And that that particular 1907 panic was because the government allowed a run on what was the name of the company? Union Copper.
Right.
And a private citizen tried to get control of the Union Copper Company because he wanted the monopoly on copper. And the when that stock started to tumble, and it was highly traded on the stock exchange at the time, it caused a panic and a run on banks. Everyone was running to get their money taken out before the bank collapsed.
But why did you start that with the government allowed it?
Well, because there was no regulation at that time, and the J.P. Morgan, who was the savior, okay, he's the one that came along and got bankers and other big tycoons to stop the fall and, excuse me, pass some of the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Well, see, it's one of my contentions that the reason that the that panic didn't last so long is because it was settled by private businessmen who had skin in the game and wanted to get it resolved quickly. And a little note from a book about the panic of 1907, and I'm sorry that I didn't record, or actually, yes, I did record Bruner and Carr of the book The Panic of 1907. They make a point that the real problem was not the attempt to corner United Copper, but the general economic conditions. Well over a decade of 7% growth had attracted investors all over the world, but the world only had so much money to invest. So the need to rebuild San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake sucked up a lot of money, leaving a shortage of liquid funds, and an attempt to corner the stock market, or the stock of one company, might not have had the repercussions in 1897 that it did in 1907. And they tell the story of a long line outside a bank in Hong Kong, leading to rumors that there was a run on the bank, which turned into a real run. In fact, the line was to a pastry shop next door to the bank. Now, what regulation could prevent that?
Nothing would have. And the 1907, what happened there was fixed by the tycoons, but they allowed, again, without any self-regulation, we wound up with another crash in 1929.
And there's some contention that that crash falls into the same category, that the favored causes that you hear so much from one side that the causes may have been much more simplistic or maybe things that we'll never really know the answer to.
It was, we'll get into that later in the show or maybe the next show. This will probably be a 2 or 3 part show where we continue to discuss it this week and our next show and our following show. But let's get on to the corporation, which comes from the Latin word corpus, which is a body of people. And that's where you get the idea that a body of people own a company.
It can be privately held, like a family, workers at a company or similar companies, or it can be publicly owned, whereby owners are merely investors. These investors are shareholders who own the company but don't run it, but they elect or appoint a board of directors to control the company in a trustworthy aspect. They choose a chairman of the board to interact with the president and usually the founder of that company to execute the wishes of the board, so they ended up calling him the chief executive officer.
And the corporate structure is allowed by the Constitution, the 10th Amendment, which gives powers to the state. So every state has separate rules and laws for incorporation in that state. But you can be a company in one state and have incorporation in another. One of the most favored states is Delaware to incorporate in because their laws are the easiest to comply with being a corporation.
A lot of people in California go to Nevada to incorporate for the same reason.
Right. The first corporations were viewed as essential to public service, and they were giving public land. They were given financing by the states, and were primarily like bridge companies, water companies. They were in transportation, banking, or insurance, where they would benefit society. They were for the purpose of the benefit of society.
And that was actually, again, as Pat outlined, they were formed for that purpose. So I personally would have no contention for those entities being controlled by the government because they were birthed by the government. And so the people were choosing to work in that environment.
And they were given a monopoly. You can imagine if you were the provider of the water for that neighborhood or city, then you would have a monopoly to collect those funds. And those were called municipalities originally. It's only in the recent history, I think if you remember, it was just in the 1970s that we deregulated or gave away the power companies, and they were no longer municipalities. They were publicly owned. They could be publicly owned. So originally, they were municipalities.
And of course, that relationship is still, the fingers are still deeply into those power companies and so on. And you can always tell just by the way they operate. And they're heavily regulated, but so is their pricing. And it's really not a free market.
Well, it's like locally, PG&E has to apply to the Public Utility Commission for rate hikes and what have you. But it's almost a rubber stamp process.
Right.
I mean, have you ever heard them denied?
Right. And that's my contention. If they had real competition, then pricing might be different.
And I think if you look at public utility, particular PG&E is an example as a power supplier, is they have a tendency to fight alternative sources of power. Years and years ago, they would buy up inventions and shelf them. Now you see them fighting tooth and nail that they don't want to have you privately have a power source at your home, be it solar or some other, and feed back into the grid. They say, well, we, you know, provide all the lines and everything, so we charge you 12 cents a kilowatt, but we're only going to pay you 2 cents a kilowatt because we get the other 10 cents.
Right. They're doing what human nature dictates. The best for me, and then you take whatever's left, and I'll get as much out of you as I can. And any one of us who says they won't do that, now maybe some of us wouldn't do that to the point of unethical maltreatment, but anybody who says they're not looking out for their self-interest is just being disingenuous.
At some point in their life, they are, unfortunately. Businesses only have 3 ways to generate money, okay? And that's they either have to sell more of what they sell, they can borrow or get a loan, and as a small business owner, you know how difficult that is. It's not easy, and if you do try and get a loan, you have to sign your life away, your wife's, anybody else that you have contact with, just about. And the other way to generate money is to get other people to invest in your idea or your business.
There's one other way that a company can get money.
How's that?
Governmental bailout.
Well, that's
true.
Not
a loan.
But that's a modern day invention, too.
But it is another way to make money.
Yes.
Although I think there were some of those bailouts a couple of hundred years ago, they just weren't called that.
Yeah, they were called, what was that, when they funded the railroad?
We said heavily subsidized.
Yeah, that's what we called it. And if you tried to get people to invest in your company, it was usually one buddy or neighbor or family member, and you called him your partner, and you created a partnership. But if you get a bunch of people to do it, the government says, no, you have to create a corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an evidence of your ownership. You get paper stock declaring the number of shares you own. And it, as time went on, and we'll talk about some of the case law and government things that gave limited liability to corporations, that is modern day reason to incorporate, is so that if you own a business and something goes wrong, if you're a sole proprietor and someone sues you, they're going to sue not only your business, but they're going to take your house and car and everything else. Whereas on a corporation, you get this illusion of distance that they'll sue the company, but not you personally.
Yeah. And I think the word illusion is probably well chosen.
Well, it's called a veil that separates you. But originally, investors had liability for their corporation.
Right.
And then legislation later on, we'll talk about, prevented that from happening.
And so, in 1839, Justice Roger Taney said, "A corporation can have no legal existence out of the boundaries of the sovereignty by which it is created." And again, remember, they were created by states. "It exists only in contemplation of laws and by the force of law. It is indeed a mere artificial being. They are to be held accountable to the state and to the public at large. They were to be held to a higher standard of public service and accountability and social responsibility and public trust." And I think the difference then was that they were to be held to that because they were an entity created by the government. And, of course, we all might have differences as to what was a higher standard of public service and accountability. That depends on a person's opinion as to what fits those criteria.
And remember, that was 1839, and the first corporation had only been in business about 25 years then. And I'm sure there were many more corporations in those 25 years. And they were beginning to see how corporations were trying to have some sort of maybe influence, and that's why they kind of reined them in, you might say.
And back then, the states did most of that regulation, and that's palatable to me because you can choose to leave a state. And I think states still retain most of the corporate regulation that's direct and obvious. But I think the federal government holds so much sway over things with all of its regulations that it's really not a matter of just the states anymore.
Yeah, particularly in the 1900s, and we'll get to that a little later. In 1855, the Supreme Court upheld those states' rights over what they called artificial bodies, that they were they were not people. They were not an entity unto themselves yet.
And legislators gave corporations after the Civil War, and the corporations got big from the defense spending and so on related to the war. Legislators gave corporations limited liability and decreased the citizens' authority over them. The Congress was afraid of the power of the press and had taken many bribes during the war.
And at that time, the Civil War caused these corporations to sell buttons and hats and fabric and boots and everything, that they got quite wealthy. But also what was happening is legislators got very corrupt with what was going on during the Civil War. And because there was a lot of what you might call booty or stuff taken in the South, property from slave owners, a lot of that was distributed again through the wealthy. And legislators did a lot of corrupt things. And the only way that would come to light is through the press. And who controlled the press? Corporations. And that's why they got a lot of favorable consideration through government in the 1860s.
Yeah, well, I think there were ties probably in both directions, maybe the press. And were they actually in monetary control of the press in those days?
Not necessarily, but your like your newspapers, which is the most common form of public dispersal of news or anything. And these were either a local city like a Boston. The city of Boston might have its own newspaper, but it was probably corporate owned. It was expensive to distribute by paper, distribute it, because everything, the cars weren't around then.
So you don't think that they were just news corporations?
No, I don't think so.
Because later large news corporations formed. So
yes.
How would they form if the news was already owned by non-news corporations?
Well, think of it as we had broadcast stations, CBS, NBC, and ABC. Okay, and that was the national broadcasting, NBC was National Corporate Broadcasting. I forget what the actual acronym was.
Oh, so you mean they were owned by news corporations?
The newspapers were independent usually. Each city, or like New York City, might have three newspapers. But the cost of doing business was pretty high, and so they were owned by a corporation. Mm-hmm. Plus, you talked about freedom of the press, and libel was still a big thing back then. And people would try and sue newspapers for libel, especially politicians. Because they thought that, okay, you're libeling me and you can't prove anything. So corporations were provided or were prepared, and then the legislator gave them limited liability so that the investors would not get sued.
Well, that I can understand. It sounds like what you're saying is that other, like, you know, fabric corporations bought the newspapers. I don't think that was the case. I think they were owned by news corporations. Because when you're saying corporate controlled, you're indicating that they would give news favorable to the corporations. I don't think
no.
It was that way.
No. The newspaper was a corporation.
Right.
And that's how we got all the news then, was by a piece of paper. And it might be a daily paper, but chances are it could be a weekly paper.
Right.
Back in this was prior to this, about the time of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a lot of damage was done to a lot of corporations.
And the feds tried to take over corporate, you know, the power over the corporations and the physical, and the Supreme Court upheld the states' rights.
Yes. And then in 1886, the 14th Amendment, which case law upheld, that Santa Clara versus the Southern Pacific Railroad, there was a clause that granted them equal protection and due process rights as citizens, okay, meaning that they were an entity in and to themselves and they had rights as a citizen did. And over time, this was kind of manipulated and interpreted to be natural person, which the Constitution gives other rights to natural persons.
Right. That's kind of one of my bones that I pick with case law, is that while it would probably be too top-heavy for every single court case to go back to the Constitution for resolution instead of going to previous rulings, I think this is how you get a kind of mission creep.
Yes.
Of the Constitution, is by having case law that changes things a little bit, and then you use that to change things a little more. And I think the system would be cleaner if every case just went back to the Constitution, even a divorce case, anything. No case law, no precedent. You always go back to the original document. Way too pie in the sky, but I think it would have prevented this creeping mold that we have.
And it's true. We have a tendency, and I don't want to say that lawyers, but court rulings on commerce have been manipulated by attorneys in case law to get what they want, because they are paid by corporations to do that.
Sure. And, you know, even if you have a settling out of court, it does change case law. And oftentimes when people settle out of court, there's really not a decision being made that's correct. It's just somebody bowing down because they don't want to spend the money.
This is true. And a lot of case law in the corporate world, because there was so much money and power, it often went to the Supreme Court. And then there would be major rulings, and then you get some of the overwhelming burdens of interpretation and legislation, you might say, being done by the Supreme Court, rather than now we have case law, so the whole country runs on this case law instead of something that was actually a law passed by Congress.
And, of course, the 1929 stock market crash caused the federal government, or they decided this time they would get involved in a much more heavy way. And so there was a lot more federal control that came after the laws of 1933, which people of my bent would tend to think that's why the Great Depression lasted so long, along with a few other factors.
Well, there was a lot of stuff going on in the 1920s, and a lot of it came about because the banks were at that time allowed to do Wall Street business, and you would have people come to the banks and there was no financial accountability. The bank would say, okay, well, what do you have? What asset do you have? And they would bring out bonds from some bank in Europe and say, this is my asset. And then the local bank would say, okay, my investors here, Wall Street, Merrill Lynch or whoever it was then, they want to take this money and invest it. So we'll accept that. There was no checking on accounting. There was no verifying of assets. It was taken at face value.
Now, how would that damage things?
Well, there was fraud. There were investors who would bring something that was evidenced by paper that never really existed from a bank that didn't exist.
So why did the bank accept them?
Because everything was taken at face value because they wanted the money he was bringing to the table to trade.
Well, if he brought money, why did he need the stock or whatever he brought?
Okay, because that's what he was putting up as collateral for the money he wanted to invest. So it was kind of like, give me a loan on this letter of credit.
So they were giving him money.
That's right. And he would turn around and invest it in stocks, and usually with that same company. So he gets a letter of credit, supposedly, from a bank in maybe Europe or the South even, and brings it to a bank that's an investment banker and says, okay, here's my collateral. I want the money so that I can buy the stocks, and I'll do it through your house, your investment house. And so it was kind of like a self-serving acceptance, but it was fraudulent, and it was, rife with corruption.
When did the transatlantic cable go in, do you know?
No, I don't.
Because I think it was already in place in 1933.
Yeah, but you had to have motive to use it.
Well, like checking with the Bank of Europe to see if...
We take that for granted today because we do have accountability laws, but back then there wasn't any.
So the bank would have suffered. We'll move on. But my point is, let the buyer beware. That's always been a great system that worked in the past.
But the crash in 1929 proved that you couldn't do that. You could not trust everything at face value when it came to finances.
Well, one thing we'll never be able to prove is what would have happened had the government done nothing after 1929?
Well,
just like when they say with the TARP and everything, well, if we hadn't done that, the recession would have been much worse. They can't prove that.
Well, there was a commission in 1929. It was the PCORA, I think it was PCORA or something, commission. And it was sponsored by Congress. And they revealed problems in the system of stock trading and banking that created the Securities Act of 1933, and that created the Securities Exchange Commission to oversee what was going on the stock exchange, and it also created Glass-Steagall, which was an act that we're all familiar with now, was passed prohibiting commercial banks from participating in investment banking business. Otherwise, the Wall Street brokerages could not use the money in the bank that they were a part of to do investment banking. And this prevented banks from speculating in securities or gambling the depositors' money of, the local guy coming in and putting his savings account in the bank thinking it was safe. So that 1933 was those kinds of measures that were passed brought faith back into banking and the stock market.
And yet, really, from what I've read, one of the main things that brought back the economy after the Great Depression, or towards the end of the Great Depression, was World War II.
That's true. But between 1929 and when the war started, which was probably 5 years, 5,000 banks failed. So if you had any money, would you put it in a bank? No.
But the 1907 only lasted for a short time.
But that did not involve savings accounts from individual people. That was strictly a stock market phenomenon, where when the banks collapsed, 5,000 banks went out of business. And think, 1929, it's not like now. You didn't have the millions of banks we have now. So 5,000 major banks collapsing was monumental. And the legislation that came out of that happened to be like the FDIC that guaranteed people, you know, if you put your money in this bank, it originally was $10,000, we'll guarantee up to $10,000 that if the bank falls apart, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, will give you back up to $10,000. So it was a way of putting faith back in the system. And we also, what was it, after 1907 crash, isn't that in 1914 or something, we created the central bank so that there was one banking entity that controlled all of these banks rather than the mishmash of trust that you might say, or self-regulation that was what was predominant at the time.
And we still had 1929.
Yes. So just having a central bank was not the solution, because the central bank is kind of like the Federal Deposit Insurance, the Federal Reserve or the Treasury Department. It's only one entity, but it doesn't have the power for the savings depositor to be guaranteed money.
Well, we can probably move on from that also, but I guess the point I'm making is that they keep trying to prevent things, but we go back to that Hong Kong story. We just can't prevent things from happening. And there have been lots of slightly smaller crashes between 1929 and all the things that have happened in current day. They try to make a fix for that, but they don't change the original fix. And
well,
it goes on and on.
The Glass-Steagall Act was actually by two senators, Glass and Steagall. And Glass was a former Treasury Secretary. And I believe Steagall was the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. So these were people that supposedly understood economics and banking and money. And they pulled together this act that would try and establish trust in the stock market and in banking.
But in 1933, the separation of commercial bank and investment bank was already considered controversial in some corners. And by 1935, Senator Glass himself attempted to repeal the prohibition on direct bank underwriting by permitting a limited amount of bank underwriting of corporate debt.
That was because the unintended consequences it had on corporate debt. It was difficult to go out and create corporate debt. Otherwise, you couldn't go get a loan as a corporation. And this was primarily affecting Wall Street, and Wall Street didn't like it.
I'll say that again. Unintended what?
Consequences.
Oh. That's the first time that ever happened, isn't it?
Well, on a large scale, maybe. And, you know, they did. They changed bank regulations. Bank regulators changed in the 1970s issues of the Glass-Steagall interpretation. Court decisions overturned portions of it. There are a lot of activity on Glass-Steagall. And in the 1990s, we wound up slowly, gutting the act until 1999, they repealed it.
And by the way, you're listening to Examine Life on KKRN Radio. And Pat and I's show has been kind of truncated tonight, so we're just running through till the end of the program. But this is KKRN Radio, 88.5 FM. In Bella Vista at Round Mountain, and we hope you're enjoying the show tonight.
And it will probably cover three segments, capitalism and corporate America. We're going to get in depth on some of, not so much the legislation, but some touch on that, but a lot about corporate America and how it is, it affects us every day.
Yeah, corporate America, has its good points and its bad points, and people nowadays like to beat up on corporations. Of course, you have to define what is a large corporation, because I'm part of a corporation, and I don't think that I'm out there damaging lives. And so there's just a lot of mixed feelings and a lot of emotion around corporate America and about capitalism. And those are the things we want to cover in the next couple of programs.
And corporations, for you and I, we both have businesses that are corporations. But we had to create a corporation to protect ourselves. We have partnerships. And so there's a lot of we need to protect our personal assets from what might happen in the business, because we're both in businesses that are likely to be challenged. We farmers now have to incorporate in order to get the tax benefits to keep their farms running. So now corporations are much more geared to tax benefits than they are so much as entities to provide for the public good or services. Corporations now are more about taxes and liability.
I'm kind of glad personally that some of that has changed, because if you think about it, a lot of corporations that were given kind of a biased support by the government because they were in alternative energies, and they crashed and burned and cost the taxpayers a lot of money because somebody thought that that corporation was good for society. So that's one of the problems I have, is any political entity deciding that this is good for society.
Well, that's what happened with the railroads. That's what happened with oil. That's what happened with steel. This country perceives that it has a great need and there's a corporation that provides a solution to that need, we seem to give away the farm to get that need satisfied.
And oftentimes it's just like airplanes, for instance. Airplanes were really developed by war, the aircraft industry. But that doesn't mean that had we not had war, that airplane development would have been something bad. It would have been different.
And slower,
Might have been slower, but would that have been a particularly horrible thing? I mean, to get to where we are today, did we have to get to there in this period of time that we did?
No, but I think we think about progress and new industries providing progress, like the railroad, it provided a solution to the East Coast wanted beef, but the beef were out in the Midwest, and the only way they could get them there was, you either had to have a cattle drive, which people did not appreciate in the East. So they brought the train out, and you could load your cattle on the train and take it to a slaughterhouse in Chicago.
But did it have to happen as soon as they wanted it to happen?
That I don't know.
Would it have turned out any worse? And I guess that's my point, is one person or one group of people, for political reasons, decided this is better for the country than the way it's going. And I don't know that they can make that decision without being prescient.
And think about the negative impact of the government subsidizing the railroad. That show that was on some station recently. It was a series of shows, and it was called Hell on Wheels, and it was about the settling of the railroad and towns and all the chaos that was created. But think about the wiping out of the buffalo. They would come on trains and shoot them from trains.
For sport.
Yes. Yeah. So it wasn't all wonderful and satisfying just to need.
And that's why I'm kind of a naturalist. I just believe things should have proceeded naturally. There were good people, there were bad people, there were land barons, there were all these bad things. But they all a lot of them resolved without intervention by new legislation.
And they still exist today.
Exactly. And they always will. Because every regulation you make will create a new type of crime. I forget who it was that said, I read the quote recently, that the more laws you create, the more criminals you have.
That's true, because everything becomes illegal. So it's much easier to break the law. And our government is what, passing 1,500 of them a year? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, without changing any of the existing ones. So corporate America is a fascinating subject because it's really gone through a big evolution from the very beginnings, when corporations were more of a created entity by the government, and they've evolved into this thing that is more about business than about the creative, the purpose they originally had as designed by and for the government. And I don't know that it's a good thing or a bad thing, but the evolution of them has been fascinating. A lot of this history I didn't know before we started this.
And I think on our next show, we might talk about that slogan that greed is good. how maybe it is and how maybe it isn't.
And I have particular thoughts about that. For instance, I've had people who are receiving public assistance who have talked to me about the evil corporations and how they have a 30% profit and they make all this money. And my contention is that if you're on public assistance, then every day you're generating a 100% profit. So are you one of the evil?
Yes, and why aren't they paying income tax?
Exactly. I think we should have a flat tax that taxes even welfare payments, not to hurt them, but because even though the money comes from the same place, if a senator decides to raise a tax, they might be a little more skeptical of him than they are now.
Well, you pay attention to what affects you. So if you have skin in the game, you're going to pay attention. And that's where that might work.
So even though your money's coming from the same source and they're turning right around and taxing it, I think it's a good idea for everyone to feel that because they will just have a different opinion.
And corporations, there are, I'm sure, evil aspects of corporate America, but there are beneficial aspects of corporate America. And if you have a 401k, chances are you're invested in corporate America.
That's right. You're one of those people, a little old lady who's retired, and you just hate these giant corporations. Well, you might not be able to eat dinner if that giant corporation doesn't make a big fat profit. And if you have them in your portfolio and you think they're evil and you don't remove them, then you're part of the problem.
And many people, seniors, live on defined retirement benefit packages.
That's right. This has been Examine Life. We're sorry for the technical difficulties we had in the program this evening, but we hope you've enjoyed the show. We've tried to cover a lot of material in a compressed time, but we're going to be back on our next program with a continuation of the subject that we just had. And we hope you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back with you in a couple of weeks.
Good night.
Good night.
The CD Spotlight, new music on